I have been asked to dictate a three-part series on the three dominant ethnic settlement patterns of Southwest Virginia. They will be presented in a roughly 45-minute segment and broadcast so as to be received on cell phones by participants who will be in their cars traveling to attend a conference in Wise County. Most will be driving down the Great Valley of Virginia on Interstate 81, just as our ancestors did. They can think about these historic events as they drive past the places connected with them. First of all, let me say that I am well aware that there were people here before the settlers from the Old World arrived. We all honor our Indian heritage, which is too multifaceted to be included here. I also acknowledge our Black heritage. I appreciate that 40% of the folks who travel down the Wilderness Road, which is roughly Interstate 81, were Black. For those people interested in Black history, I recommend Alex Haley's Roots, which I cannot equal. We will be discussing the three dominant ethnic groups from the Old World who settled this area in chronologic sequence to their arrival. Today we will present the first, the Spanish Berber. Presentations of the Germans and Scotch-Irish will follow separately. In 1492, Columbus discovered the New World by landing on an unknown island in the Bahamas, Cuba, and Hispaniola. In later voyages, he landed on other islands of the Caribbean, the mainland of South America, and of Central America. He did not ever reach North America. In 1513, Juan Ponce de Leon explored Florida, and Hernando Cortes discovered and colonized Mexico in 1519. From 1539 to 1542, Hernando de Soto explored much of what is now the southeastern United States of America in the name of Spain. Spain and Portugal had both once been a province of the Carthaginian Empire, which Rome later acquired when it defeated Carthage. The Romans called it Hispania. In 711, the Muslim Berbers of northwest Africa, who also had been a part of the Carthaginian Empire, conquered Hispania, also now called the Iberian Peninsula. Due to a mountain range that separated Portugal from Spain and to the isolation that resulted, the two languages began to emerge and a sense of separate identities developed. Starting in the 9th century, Portugal became independent of Spain but continued stronger ties with the Berbers of Africa. After the discovery of the New World, Spain and Portugal became competitors in the race to explore it. Trying to avoid outright conflict, they sought mediation by Pope Alexander VI, who was a Spaniard. The Pope set up a north-south line dividing the New World between the Spanish and the Portuguese, known as the Line of Demarcation, in 1492. He gave the lion's share to Spain, and Portugal objected. So with the Treaty of Tordesillas of 1494, the line was shifted westward a little. This alienated France, which was also a Catholic country. England was pushed further along the path of separating its church from the Vatican. As a practical result, Portugal got what is now Brazil, and Spain got everything else. Not surprisingly, neither England nor France honored the line of demarcation. In 1534, Jack Cartier discovered Canada for France. With the stage therefore set, Spain began to assert its control over much of what is now the southeastern United States of America. We need to go back to 1492 to pick up another chain of events that ran parallel to these outlined earlier, and which converged with the process of discovery and settlement. Queen Isabella and King Ferdinand of Spain had long been at war with the Muslim south of the country and had defeated them the same year that they had commissioned Columbus to embark on his voyage of discovery. The victorious Spanish Christians rounded up all the Moorish men and all the Moorish women over childbearing age and took them out to sea and tossed them overboard. Women of childbearing age and children were given the option of either converting to Christianity or taking a one-way voyage at sea. Most chose to convert. The term applied to them was conversio, or morisco. The same process was applied to the Spanish Jews, who were called Sephardics. This created a massive excess of women in Spain. At this point, it was discovered that many of the conversios were secretly practicing their old religion in their homes. The Spanish Christian rulers perceived that they had two problems, which was, first of all, a need for colonists for their New World conquests, and secondly, they needed to get the conversios out of the country. At this point, Spain had temporarily acquired Portugal through a dynastic marriage. Portugal had maintained ties with the Berbers of Northwest Africa to a greater extent than had Spain. A disproportionate number of conversios were Portuguese. The Spanish Christian rulers therefore decided that they could solve both of their perceived problems at one stroke. The Spanish, in contradistinction to the English, did not maintain a distinction between colony and a military base. They set up a family unit which consisted of one Spanish Christian soldier and his legal wife, a Christian Spanish woman, and 3 to 5 conversio widows who were officially designated as household servants and sent them off into the New World. These family units were, therefore, predominantly Portuguese of Berber ancestry. As one would expect, the one man kept all females reproducing at maximum capacity. The modern state of Florida was first explored and settlement started in 1513 by Juan Ponce de Leon. The Spanish there kept hearing rumors from the Indians of gold to be found to the south. Hernando de Soto responded to these rumors by landing a massive expeditionary force on the western side of the Florida Peninsula in 1539. That year, he worked his way north to the Panhandle and spent time with the Apalache Indians at their town at the mouth of the river by that name. The next year, De Soto went north through Georgia and South Carolina and into the Yadkin River Valley of North Carolina, stopping at Uara. This Indian village was located at a major crossroads of Indian trails, one traveling east to west along the Yadkin River Valley to the coast at both the Albemarle and Pamlico Sounds, and the other a major north-to-south trail coming from the Charleston, South Carolina area to Saltville, Virginia, and on to the Ohio country. Uara is at Morganton, North Carolina. De Soto followed current Interstate 40 to Asheville, and then took the Nolichucky River Valley to the Tennessee River, which he followed to the mouth of the Little Tennessee, where the capital of the Overhill Cherokee, Chota, lay. He stayed there a while and sent expeditions up the Holston River toward Virginia, and Juan de Villalobos and Francisco de Silveira, along with Indian guides, into present Lee County, Virginia. From there, he turned to the states along the lower Mississippi, where he died. In the years 1541 to 1545, the French were intensely active in the North Atlantic. They built a trading post in a settlement at Los Bacalos, which was near Point of Santa Elena, which is near present Paris Island, South Carolina. They made annual trips to buy gold, pearls, marten skins, and other things from the Indians. Soon after the Spanish conquered Mexico, they began to transport gold and silver to Spain. This flow was greatly augmented by their loot from Peru. The treasure galleons would hitch a ride on the Gulf Stream as it passed up the coast of the present southeastern United States. Navigation was easy, as it involved keeping the coast in sight until it reached a prominent cape, such as Cape Hatteras or Long Island. Then they would set a bearing due east, which would bring them to the coast of Iberia, where they would recognize where they were. Pirates soon began to prey upon the treasure galleons. These pirates needed safe harbors along the route to hide in and to repair their ships and to take in water. The outer banks, the inland waterway, and the sounds, and the bays and river mouths that are plentiful along the southeastern coast were infected with pirates. Portugal, France, and the Barbary coast of North Africa, which is the home of the Berbers, and especially England, were the origins of most of these pirates, who were joined by significant numbers of French Huguenots and German pietists. Queen Elizabeth was especially involved in encouraging pirates, and then denied to the Spanish that she was doing so. She even had a spymaster, who seems to have been also in charge of her pirates, named Sir Francis Walsingham. Simon Fernandez and John Callis were perhaps her best-documented pirates. They operated out of South Wales. Fernandez was especially familiar with the coast of Virginia, which included North Carolina at this point. At one point, at least a third of the merchandise for sale in some English coastal cities was plunder supplied by pirates. As England and Spain drew closer and closer to war, and Spain began to hang her pirates, Elizabeth began to commission them as privateers, which gave them a status as combatants and protected them from execution. The Chesapeake Bay became a favorite hideout for pirates and privateers. The specifics are poorly documented, but the generalities are well known, especially in Spanish records. The Spanish government began to send ships into the Chesapeake to explore the area and to look for evidences of pirate activity. They found numerous sites where the pirates had beached their ships for repair. They became especially concerned about the French, who had penetrated the lower Mississippi, which the Spanish noted lay just to the north of the silver mines in Mexico. Tangier Island and the Chesapeake became a haven for these picaroons, a Spanish term for these thieves. Though the term is largely forgotten in the United States, in Mexico they still teach their children about the terrible picaroons. To counter these threats, the King of Spain ordered the naval officer Pedro Mendez Avilés to become governor of Spanish Florida. He built the capital of his province at the previously mentioned Point Santa Elena in 1566. It was no inconsequential affair. A list of surnames of these some 400 soldiers and settlers exists and shows them to have been predominantly Imazigan, with Portuguese and Spanish alterations to their spellings. The Imazigan are a tribe of Berbers from the Atlas Mountains of northwest Africa. The Spanish became uneasy about their capacity to counter the pirate and privateer threat along the coast and ordered Juan Pardo to develop an overland route from Santa Elena to the Mexican silver mines. In December 1566, he embarked with 250 men on an exploratory expedition to do so. He took the watery Catawba River system from just up the coast from Charleston, South Carolina, to Yuhara, where De Soto had stopped 26 years earlier. Pardo, himself a Portuguese and possibly a conversio, had been an officer in that expedition. His surname is Portuguese Sephardic Jewish. There he built Fort San Juan, which was at least a blockhouse and may have included a palisade and a moat. After waiting for winter weather to clear, he proceeded down the De Soto Trail into East Tennessee. Some believe that he built another fort there. He received word that the French were threatening Santa Elena and abandoned his attempt to get to Mexico and return to Santa Elena, leaving Hernando Moyano de Morales in command of 30 soldiers. Up the Indian Trail from Fort San Juan to the north lay the Yuchi Nation, owners and operators of the largest salt operation in the present United States. They traded salt as far away as Texas. They controlled the Great Warrior's Path as it passed through southwest Virginia. The Yuchi chief and Moyano got into a mutual intimidation contest, with the chief telling Moyano to behave himself, or the chief would come and eat him and his dog. Moyano took a party of 30 men to Saltville, claiming to have killed 2,000 Indians. In the late 1800s, a body of a Spanish soldier in period armor was found near Jacobs Creek, near the Appalachian Trail south of Bristol, hidden in the recesses of rocks. A period Spanish coin was found associated with his body. The site is on the trail back to Morganton. More recently, archaeologists have discovered and examined a site on the Nolichucky River near Erwin, Tennessee, that documents several features of the above story. East Tennessee State University has been excavating a field that it calls the Runyon Site, which has been shown to have been a large fortified town protected on the east by the Nolichucky River and to the west by a moat. It is a multicultural site containing both an overhill Cherokee population and a Spanish one. Artifacts that have been found there are early-styled overhill pottery, an iron needle, several brass artifacts, fragments of an olive jar, the lead ball from an arquebus, which is a matchlock musket, and a Spanish coin. Speculative connections are to DeSoto, Pardo, or Sergeant Moyano, and even to Fort San Pablo. In essence, there are three river valleys whose headwaters could have reasonably been used by the Spanish at Yuara to have accessed the Tennessee River Valley and Chota. They are the French Broad, the Nolichucky, and the Little Tennessee. There is archaeologic evidence to support each of these routes, and each has its modern proponents. The Nolichucky route is currently the most popular, but in recent times both the other routes have also been highly regarded. On the French Broad River, a Spanish blockhouse has been located near Ivy Creek at an Indian village phonetically rendered as either Cowichi or Cauchi. It was built in either November or December 1567 by the Juan Pardo expedition. Between 15 and 30 men were left here to garrison the fort, and probably they did not survive the winter. The more traditionally favored route from Morganton via Asheville to Chota has been along the Chiricahua Skyway, which is State Routes 165 and 143, which is maintained by the states of North Carolina and of Tennessee as a historic and scenic route. Robbinsville, North Carolina, is the nearest town, but Hooper's Bald is the most significant site in the larger region. The area, which today includes parts of Tennessee, North Carolina, and Georgia, once were Creek Indian territory, but was taken by the Cherokee in the frontier era. The gold mines in that part of Georgia were the basic cause of the Cherokee expulsion that centered around 1840. The region is said to be heavily loaded with Spanish artifacts. The people that worked the mines are variously said to have been Sephardic Jews or Melungeons, whom the Cherokee call round faces. Melungeon is an Arabic term for Berbers. Hooper's Bald is a mountaintop meadow which has within it a large stone outcropping on which is inscribed a notation written in Sephanic Jewish Spanish, an inscription commemorating the marriage and honeymoon of a Sephardic Jewish couple. It would seem that there is sufficient evidence to support the usage of all three routes by the Spanish. There is also further evidence of Confergio Sephardic Jews in the southeastern United States. Note the following excerpt from an old Spanish text. Quote, in 1644, Manasseh met Antonio de Montezinas, a Portuguese traveler, and Morano, a Sephardic Jew who had been in the New World. End quote. In 1670, John Lederer, a famed German explorer from Virginia, noted when he was in the Roanoke River Valley of North Carolina, near the border with South Carolina, that 2.5 days' travel away there lived a powerful nation of bearded men whom he presumed to have been either Spanish or the English survivors of the lost colony. He described them as having a worship ceremony wherein at a specific time of day they prostrated themselves toward a bell. This practice was also known among the Armenians, who were a part of the Byzantine army that conquered the Vandal Carthaginian Empire of Mauritania in 530 AD. This pre-Christian paganism persisted in the Berbers, who conquered Iberia and who were the grunts of the Spanish colonial armies in the New World. It is becoming apparent that the Spanish penetration of western North Carolina, of East Tennessee, and of southwest Virginia was extensive. Now, back at Santa Elena, and the growing concern of the government of Spanish Florida about the threatening developments to its north. In 1571, Pedro Mendez Avillas, who was for years had been a captain of the Spanish treasure fleet, was given two small ships and the responsibility of exploring the coast of North America for 100 leagues north of Santa Elena. About the same time, Angel Villafane, who was commissioned to explore the same territory. One of these expeditions picked up an Indian boy somewhere in the Chesapeake, most likely on the peninsula between the York and James Rivers. They gave him the name Don Luis Velasco. He was a local chief of significance, and is thought to have either been the father of, or the brother of, Chief Powhatan. In other records, the dates 1559 to 1560 are implied. The dates are contradictory, giving confusion to the circumstances of Don Luis, as a letter of Menendez was dated 1565, mentions Don Luis as the Indian in New Spain. He referred to his home as Ajacan, and the Spanish gave this name to a large province in Florida, 37 degrees north of the equator and 170 leagues distant from Santa Elena. The province of Ajacan evolved by the Spanish definition to include all the land that drained into the Chesapeake Bay, which included parts of New York State, Pennsylvania, Maryland, West Virginia, and Virginia. In 1568, Menendez wrote a letter to the king expressing his expanding views of the importance of Ajacan to the Spanish crown. He mentioned that the Portuguese were fortifying the Chesapeake Bay, which most likely referred to the enclaves built by the Spanish pirates and privateers. He further describes the bay as the key to all the fortifications in Florida, that the bay controlled a rich trade with the Indians from the interior and contained a water passage to the far east. The king gave 230,000 crowns to Menendez's plan to colonize the bay. Implicit in correspondence is the reality that the Spanish possession of the bay would help in defense of the treasure fleet against the pirates that used it as a base of operations. Menendez sent a captain with 30 soldiers and two Dominican friars to colonize the Chesapeake, but they mutinied it on the way. In 1570, a group of Jesuits, with Don Luis as guide, tried again to establish a mission on the Chesapeake. Don Luis guided them to the site of his tribe, and they landed on the peninsula just downstream from the future site of Jamestown. They took the traditional portage north, passing within 2 miles of the future site of Williamsburg, and into the York River. The site likely is contained within the bounds of the naval station located there. The mission and colony was called Ajacan. In February 1571, tensions with Don Luis's tribe over the Jesuits' demands for food boiled over. Don Luis himself led the Indians in an attack on the mission. All the Jesuits were killed over a period of several days. The Indians spared only a young Spanish boy named Alonso. He lived with the Indians for a while and later was rescued by other Spaniards who sailed into the area. This was the end of the Spanish attempts to colonize anywhere north of Santa Elena. The story shifts to Sir Francis Drake. Born in Devonshire about 1541, in the 1560s, he fell in with his second cousin, John Hawkins, the famous English sea dog. He started his career in the slave trade, raided Panama, engaged in the undeclared war between England and Spain. Drake, in collaboration with the officials in London, conceived of an epic voyage through the Straits of Magellan and into the Pacific. He wished to find the Northwest Passage from its western end. Along the way, he plundered the Spanish treasure fleet, which had never met an enemy in the Pacific. It was widely assumed that all this was done with the secret blessing of Queen Elizabeth. With his ship, the Golden Hind, heavily laden with treasure, he limped across the Pacific and recalked his leaking ship in the Philippines. Returning to England, Queen Elizabeth knighted him, and he became a Member of Parliament. In 1585, the Queen ordered him to attack the Spanish colonies, so he ransacked the Atlantic of Portuguese and Spanish shipping and raided Brazil. In 1586, he raided St. Augustine, Florida. He then went to the English colony at Roanoke Island and took most of the original colonists with him back to England. A small contingent remained. The next day, a supply ship arrived, including new colonists. In 1578, he again sailed the Straits of Magellan, but returned the way he had come. In 1587, he sailed into the heart of the ports of Cadiz and Coruña and destroyed 37 vessels. During the battle with the Spanish Armada in 1588, he was Vice Admiral of the English fleet. In 1589, he was ordered to support the rebellion of Portugal against Spain. He resumed his attacks on the Spanish colonies. He died of diarrhea off the coast of Panama and was buried at sea in a lead coffin. As part of her undeclared war with Spain, Queen Elizabeth and Sir Humphrey Gilbert commissioned Sir Walter Raleigh, a favorite courtier of Elizabeth's, to attack the colony in the New World. His charter gave the usual purposes for exploration, but also contained a frank statement that the colony was to serve as a base of operations for privateers to attack the Spanish treasure galleons. The ships landed on Roanoke Island in 1585. The island was well situated, hidden behind the Outer Banks, and very close to Santa Elena. The commander of the expedition, Sir Richard Grenville, helped the colonists establish themselves, and that fall left with a promise of returning the next year with supplies. The ship was slow in arriving, and conflict with the Indians had erupted. That summer, Sir Francis Drake arrived and took the settlers back to England. The next day, Grenville arrived with the relief ship. Finding the settlement abandoned, he left behind 15 men to maintain a presence in the colony. In 1587, Raleigh sent 115 new settlers, who were left on Roanoke Island, with a promise of a relief ship the next year. The attack of the Spanish Armada prevented that voyage. The continuing war with Spain delayed the relief ship until 1590, and when it arrived at Roanoke Island, all the settlers were gone. The Spanish at Santa Elena knew about the Roanoke colony, but had few details. They had no idea of the problems that the colony was experiencing. Given the significant amount of spying that went on back and forth between the Spanish and English courts, it seems likely that Spain knew that privateering was the major purpose of the colony. The increased English leadership in the privateering originating in the Chesapeake Bay provided them with a ready example of how bad it could get. Spain had sucked all the available money, supplies, support vessels, and manpower out of its colonies in order to build and to support the Armada in its invasion of England, which was supposed to have ended the privateering entirely. The governor of Spanish Florida feared invasion by the English to the north of him. Perhaps he exaggerated that potential in his own mind. But it was true, was it not, that the terrible Drake was in the area and that he had stopped off at Roanoke? One cannot overstate the fear that Drake stirred up in the Spanish. The Indians in the interior of North Carolina were in revolt. He decided that the best move was to evacuate all the Spanish forces at St. Helena and its interior forts and to reestablish his capital at St. Augustine, Florida. The evacuation must have been done in great haste. The command to evacuate got to Fort San Juan at Yuara, but not to any of the Spanish in the interior to the west. No one will ever know how many conversios were left behind, but the DNA evidence available today would suggest that they were very numerous. DNA is not often thought of as an archaeologic artifact, but indeed, it is the most readily available and the least disputable. A reasonable way to estimate the number of conversios left in western North Carolina, North Georgia, and Tennessee would be to assess the DNA of current residents of these areas. If pockets of stable long-term residents could be assayed, so much the better. The best such group of modern residents would be the Cherokee on the Quayla Reservation at Cherokee, North Carolina. They are all certified Cherokee by the United States government. Each member of the group is individually certified as such and has a government-issued number. They were here when the Spanish came and have been here ever since. The North Carolina Cherokee were chosen because after 180 years in the West, the Oklahoma Cherokee were so thoroughly mixed with other ethnic groups that any DNA test markers obtained would have been meaningless. Starting in 2007, DNA Consultants Incorporated began testing the certified Cherokee of the Quayla Reservation. The laboratory immediately stumbled into a scientific hornet's nest. That Cherokee princess in someone's genealogy was most likely a Jewish or North African princess. Its scientists have labeled the Cherokees not as Native Americans, but as a Middle Eastern North African population. Cherokees have the highest level of test markers associated with the Berbers, Native Egyptians, Turks, Lebanese, Hebrews, Mesopotamians. Genetically, they are more Jewish than the typical American Jew of European ancestry. So-called full-blooded Cherokee have high levels of European DNA and a trace of Asiatic or American DNA. These results should have been anticipated. Ever since inexpensive DNA testing has been available to the general public, many of the white neighbors of the Quayla Cherokee have had their DNA analyzed. Many of these people have proud family traditions that they have a Cherokee great-grandmother or perhaps a great-great-grandmother in their family tree. The author has had many of these people bring in their DNA reports to him for explanation. The same issue has often been discussed at meetings of groups who are interested in their ancestry. These results have almost universally shown Western Mediterranean, where they should have expected to have seen Native American. Native American DNA has been extremely hard to find in such samples. The explanation for this phenomenon is not hard to find. It is smallpox. Smallpox is a disease caused by a virus that was confined to the Old World. There was none in the New World before Columbus. In the Old World, everyone, sooner or later, caught it. 50% of those who caught it died from it. The survivors acquired lifelong immunity to it. In the New World, everyone caught it, and 95% died from it. In 1714, smallpox wiped out the Yuchi. The Catawbas were the next in this area to get it, and for all practical purposes were wiped out. In 1738, smallpox struck the Cherokee, and only half died. This means that even at this early date, the Cherokee were pretty much Old World people. It was not until the French and Indian War that significant British and German people were available for intermarriage with the Cherokee. The Spanish had been in close contact for three-quarters of a century by this time, as documented by the mixed people that were living at the current Runyon archaeological dig on the Nolichucky. Ever since then, being Cherokee has been a cultural phenomenon and not a genetic one. Given the above facts, one should reasonably expect that there would be significant amounts of Berber culture in the Appalachian Mountains. In fact, that is the case. It is so pervasive that it is hiding in plain sight. The following is a partial list of examples of Berber culture endemic to the greater Appalachian Mountain area in the United States. A specific set of surnames, a specific set of female first names, snake handling, using hamhock to flavor kale and other greens, open-air salt-cured ham, the tambourine, speaking in tongues, the bull tongue plow, haggling as a part of the process of trading, xenophobia, a desire to live in the mountains, dislike of authority, a long-term memory of all ill-treatment, grits, which in the old world is derived from wheat rather than corn as it is in the United States, tap dancing, hip swing while dancing, cockfighting, the rebel yell, Donatism, which is the religious doctrine of primitive Baptists, the doctrine of free will Baptist, Arianism, which is Latter-day Saints doctrine, the site of origin in America of the Holiness and Church of God being Monroe County, Tennessee, which is also the site of the capital of the Overhill Cherokee, Chota. A good way to view the significance of the existing Spanish influence in the southeastern United States is to make reasonable speculations on that influence and what it would have been if Spain had won the War of the Spanish Armada. Most Americans of today are aware that the present state of Florida was once a Spanish colony. Very few are aware that the original definition of that province of the Spanish Empire extended to include North Carolina and all the current states to the south of it, and that its capital was on Parris Island, South Carolina. Very few modern Americans are aware that north of that, the Spanish had a province of Adjacan, which included everything north of North Carolina, including the Chesapeake Bay and its drainage system extending to the Catskills of New York State. The reality on the ground was that there would have been no English, Swedish, or Dutch presence on the eastern coast of the United States, and that only the French would have been available to have competed with the Spanish for possession of North America. The United States would never have existed, nor would the first British Empire. What all this would have meant concerning the Napoleonic Wars, the Wars of German Consolidation, two World Wars, and the Cold War is beyond imagination. The world as we know it would not exist. As far as the ethnic origins of the people of Southwest Virginia goes, at the end of the last lecture on this series, we shall see how the people of the Yadkin Valley and the Smoky Mountains of North Carolina came pouring into Virginia from the New River Valley westward in 1771. Anyone wishing to obtain a downloadable copy of this essay can access it on my website at bigstonegappublishing.org. There is a pull-down menu at the top of the first screen which says Other Writings. Pull down on that and go to an essay which carries in it the term Spanish Armada. And that will be the present essay. You're welcome to download it and to disseminate it as you wish.